Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothian-McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette.
The political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm head of programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, Liam Byrne, the Labour MP who is chair of the House of Commons Business and Trade Select Committee and served on the front bench for both Prime Ministers Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, has a new book. It's called The Inequality of Wealth, Why It Matters and How to Fix It. He's joined in conversation for this episode by the economist and writer Tej Parekh, who is economics leader writer for the Financial Times. Let's join Tej now with more.
Our guest today is Liam Byrne, and today we'll be discussing his latest book, The Inequality of Wealth. In the book, he outlines the drivers behind rising inequality and also outlines a number of potential recommendations to policy changes going forward to address it. Welcome to Intelligence Squared, Liam.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
So I think the best place to start is your motivations for writing this. Now, of course, we've been discussing inequality for a long time. So what made you feel like now was the time to do this?
I suppose there's two big motivations. I mean, the first is just the reality of the moral emergency that confronts you as a constituency MP in constituencies like mine in East Birmingham. As some people know, I lost my dad to what was a lifelong struggle with alcohol about 8 years ago. And that sparked a lot of work in the homeless community in Birmingham. And the kind of stories and the people that I was meeting on the streets of Birmingham were just incredibly distressing. I mean, there was at one point on Sunday morning, we found somebody lying on the ground in an underpass by New Street Station, double amputee, lying by his wheelchair. And he'd been there for 2 days and he was still dressed in his hospital gown from discharge from hospital. We have food banks in my constituency that are now literally running out of food. I have a member of staff who's part of their job is to try and make sure that we have food banks that are well stocked. So we've got levels of poverty now in my city that I've just not seen before and certainly have not seen before in my time in public life. But of course, this is alongside an extraordinary period of wealth. You've got super yacht sales at all-time high. Rolls-Royce has just had their best year ever. Home prices on Phillimore Gardens in London have just now hit 26 million. I mean, you could buy a whole street in my constituency like that. So this is a moment of moral emergency where the gap between rich and poor is just extreme. But of course, what I can see is how it's going to get worse, because as the baby boomers die, £5.5 trillion is going to cascade down the generations. Some will inherit riches, but some will inherit care bills. And so however bad inequality is today, it could be about to get an awful lot worse. So as a politician, we worry about the economics of that, but we also worry about the politics of that. And I think there's now more and more political science that shows that those places where wealth is left behind are the places that are much, much more likely to vote for populists, like Trump or Le Pen or the far right in Scandinavia. And indeed, those were the places that voted for Brexit in the UK. So inequality of wealth has quite big political effects as well as moral effects. And of course, I suppose this is the second reason, really, is that this is the 10th anniversary of Thomas Piketty's great book on capital. And for those familiar with that debate, you'll know that the great challenge that was given to Piketty by his mentor, Tony Atkinson, was, OK, look, you've done a great analysis of the problem here, but what are the solutions? And we desperately now need, 10 years on from that book, to identify solutions that people will not only like on social media, but will actually vote for at an election. And this election this year could well be the chance to really make that change. So those are the kind of two big reasons, sure. I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think economists have been debating inequality over the last decade, both on what measures you might use to explain it, but also the timeframes you use that also influences how stark the differences are. But at one point I wanted to bring out, you know, the debate aside on the actual numbers is, in your book you mentioned that the perception of the wealth gap has grown. So let's say it hadn't statistically actually grown. People perceive that they are poorer than those at the top. And one of the concepts you bring into the book is this idea of the absurdity of affluence. And I just wondered if you could explain what you meant by that. I mean, you touched on some examples just now, but just it'd be great to hear more about that.
So I was born in 1970 in the holy town of Warrington. And over the course of my life, the wealth of our country has multiplied 100-fold. So net household wealth in the UK is about £12.2 trillion. That's a big number to get your head around. It's enough to basically pave a path of bullion bars, 5.5 bars wide, from Gyrogates to Land's End. That's kind of how much £12 trillion is. But for most of my life, since I was born, the way that we shared that wealth was getting fairer. It was getting more equal. But then things changed in around 2010. So from about 2010, the wealth of the top 1% has multiplied by about 31 times more than everybody else in Britain. And that's part of a global story. And that's why you do now have not one person, but three people racing into space. That's why you do have this extraordinary absurdity of affluence, which is Bernie Sanders' phrase in the book, of people buying super yachts and Rolls-Royce cars with a paint job that matches the colour of their jets. And the absurdity of affluence, you know, will offend many. Others will say, well, look, people should spend their money how they choose. The thing that really concerns me, though, is less the conspicuous consumption and more the inconspicuous consumption, not of things, but of power. And what I see in Westminster now is the way in which extreme wealth turns into investment in political ecosystems, ownership of news channels, ownership of newspapers, donations into a think tank, direct political donations to a political party. You quickly begin to see inequalities of wealth translate into inequalities of power. And of course, that's not a novel insight. If you look at countries around the world that are very unequal, they very quickly become corrupt. They very quickly become poor because of tax avoidance. And they very quickly become stagnant as social mobility begins to collapse, because the heirs of those that are born with a lot get to jump to the front of the queue when it comes to the opportunities in life. And you can see traits of all of those three things now beginning to bedevil Britain. And it will get worse unless we take a conscious decision as a country to change course.
Sure. I mean, that's what I was going to bring up now, actually. So, I mean, a lot of people would, you know, I guess, push back and say it doesn't matter how, you know, people have a free choice about how they want to spend their money. But on the inconspicuous consumption element, how are the wealthy buying influence? Be interested to kind of dig into to the type of things that money allows them to do in politics.
Yeah, I mean, they buy or invest in news channels like GB News, for example. You know, GB News brings a political perspective that is predominantly to the right of the right. many of the people involved in that are journalists who are also writing for centre-right newspapers. Many of the ideas that they're writing about are ideas that have been funded on the right in think tanks based in Tufton Street. And so you can begin now to see the way in which a kind of climate of opinion can be influenced by strategic investments in the media, into think tanks, into academia, and of course directly into leadership campaigns, for example. So when you have got extreme wealth, it inevitably affects power, because of course down the generations, if you look at all the great successful entrepreneurs in British history, and my previous book was about a history of British capitalism told through the lives of some of those entrepreneurs are very different, but they have one thing in common. They all end up as quite hungry for power, and they all acquire quite serious political influence over the course of their careers. And you can see that same thing happening now.
Yeah, I think this raises a very interesting point about the role of entrepreneurs and innovation. So, you know, what you've kind of outlined is that often some of the innovation can get channeled into what I would like innovations within consumerism, and that allows that, you know, they can earn more and more money that way. But the innovation towards things that raise productivity that could equally raise productivity for the whole society and raise wages. Is there an issue in the way in which innovation is channeled?
This is such a good question. So exactly right. And part of the book, a core of the book, is a reflection on what we got wrong in New Labour. I began my career in Milbank Tower in 1996. I was a minister under Tony Blair. You know, we had a particular view of economics, and we've now learned a lot about what was wrong with that economics. There's not been a kind of a new John Maynard Keynes since the financial crash, but there have been some really big insights from the new institutional economists, the neo-Schumpeterians, and the behavioral economists. And if you put their analysis together, what it basically describes is a story about privilege, technopoly, and bubble. So people are basically able to acquire privileges or rents very quickly. They will build from that monopolistic or oligopolies, which are getting stronger and stronger. But these oligopolies are different now because they combine network effects as well as using data to lock consumers in. And of course, you know, we now know that it's pretty difficult to escape boom and bust cycles. But when those boom and bust cycles unfold, generally speaking, it's the richer that richest that recover fastest and the poorest which take longest to recover. Now, you put all those three things together, you get some very big system effects that lean towards inequality. But within that system, you've got entrepreneurs who are often building great businesses, but are then trying to guard their positions in the markets through influence on regulation, through influence on tax, to basically safeguard the competitive advantages that they've built. And again, that's not a novel insight. That's something that Joseph Schumpeter predicted many, many years ago. But in a global economy, you do get some very big and powerful individuals who have got not just economic power, but political power. And so that becomes market distorting for everybody else.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the other... the challenge also for entrepreneurs is, you know, the type of high risk research and development that could in the long term benefit society. Maybe the incentive structures or the institutions aren't in place for them to take those risks. And so what you get is these kind of incremental innovations that, you know, updates to your kind of iPhone model or whatnot, rather than, you know, larger scale things. I mean, just touching on that, I wanted to get your sense of AI, because that is a big topic right now. Do you see the same trends there in terms of AI driving a wedge in inequality?
Yeah. So this is one of the great risks of the future. And it's one of the reasons that we have really got to begin acting now about economic inequality. So if you take some of the best data around, like, say, from Carl Frey and others at Oxford Martin School, and apply that to the British economy, you quite quickly get to an estimate that suggests that automation and AI could destroy more jobs than the shutdown of the coal industry and the steel industry put together. And those that are most vulnerable to AI, there are some white-collar jobs in there, but there's also a lot of transportation jobs, a lot of retail jobs, a lot of low-pay jobs, in other words. So AI basically could act as a great destroyer of economic opportunity for those without skills. Now, that is likely to unfold at the same time as new advances in wealth management that allow those that have already got significant assets to safeguard those assets down the generation. So economists like Brooke Harrington at Dartmouth have written incredibly persuasively about how today's wealth management industry stops the kind of traditional cycle of sandals to the stars and back to the sandals in three generations, which has always been a characteristic of capitalist evolution. So on the one hand, you've got the preservation of wealth with a new kind of integrity for the future. But on the other hand, you've got AI potentially destroying a lot of low-skill working class jobs. And so there are two big system effects that could well multiply economic and inequality over the course of the next 10 to 20 years. And it would be naive of us to imagine that that's not going to have a profound political impact.
And before we cast things forward and look ahead, I just wanted to... There was a section of your book where you try to tackle this argument that, you know, millennials and Gen Z, they may have had struggles getting onto the housing ladder, but then they might be inheriting a lot of the wealth that their parents and the baby boomer generation had. So, you know, some may argue that actually this may compensate for it. But I wanted to kind of just... You touched on this in your introduction. I mean, what are your kind of counter arguments there? I mean, obviously, not everybody will be inheriting the same wealth. It won't be distributed equally. But are there kind of other risks here?
Yeah, there are. So there are two risks. And writers on the FT like John Burns Murdoch have done a great job at just helping us visualize this new inheritocracy. So on the one hand... As the baby boomers shuffle off this mortal coil and bequeath their fortunes to their children, wealth inequality will increase because some will inherit lots and some will inherit very little. The second effect, though, is on asset prices. So when I was born, net household wealth was about three times national labour income. Today, net household wealth is... worth about 10 times national labour income. So household wealth is a reflection of asset prices. So asset prices are basically 10 times the national labour income. So if you don't own assets today, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to gather together the wages that you might need and therefore the savings you might need in order to buy the assets, because the assets are just much more expensive today relative to wages than they were back in 1970. So if you haven't got assets, if you're asset-less, you are increasingly priced out of the market for assets. And at the same time, you're in a cohort which is much more unequal.
Sure. And I mean, just pushing things forward now. So we've outlined some of the dynamics in your book, the way the role innovation plays, the role inheritance plays, and some of the broader kind of economic trends that might exacerbate inequality. If the status quo stayed as it was, how would things look in 20 years' time? How would you kind of describe the state of the country?
So I think the state of the country will basically be this. Gen Z will be the most unequal generation that we've had for at least 50 years. But that will that phenomenon will unfold amongst a generation that is much more connected with social media and much better able to mobilize when it comes to protest. So you will end up with an unequal society that is also a much more febrile society. And you can already see our culture beginning to give us the warning signs. So this cultural phenomenon, which some call wealth porn, you know, shows like Succession or Above Deck, Below Deck, or you know, real Housewives. I mean, you've got you've got lots of kind of cultural elements now, basically providing that kind of choreographed mockery of the super rich, which is how we've dealt with upstartish behavior for millennia. But that culture is a warning signal. And the polling behind this is quite interesting. So we ran a poll last year that asked who is the most powerful in Britain. People in Britain today think the top 1% are the most powerful in Britain. Now, we ran the same poll 4 years ago, and people thought government was the most powerful. So people have got a sense of how the top 1% now are becoming more and more powerful. And that will almost inevitably have a political impact.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Sure, and actually I was going to ask, you know, how do you see the state of democracy then if this status quo continued? I mean, how... Will it just become very difficult to push forward certain policies and drive growth if there is such a large division?
So Martin Wolf has written very thoughtfully about this, I think, and the relationship between the breakdown of an economy that works for everybody and a political polarization. That will definitely get worse. Martin is right to pin down that trend. It will definitely get worse if inequality does get worse. But what's the solution to that? The solution to that is you've got to build coalitions for change between the bottom 90% and people in the top 10%. And what that means in practice, in real life, is building coalitions between grandparents, the baby boomers, and grandchildren, millennials and Gen Z, because a lot of that asset wealth is concentrated in the hands of the over 65s. And unless we can provide solutions that the over 65s are prepared to vote for, then political progress is likely to be really slow and really difficult. If we don't get this right, you will get populism continuing to flourish. And I think in a country like ours, the opposite of populism is actually separatism. I think you will get separatist pressures in places like Scotland that become far more pronounced. And you will see separatist pressures across Europe get a lot stronger too, as people react to the rise of populists taking over particular capitals. You will have particular regions that just want to go their own way. So the kind of centrifugal pressures on the state will get sharper and sharper unless we come up with a policy mix that actually helps share wealth more fairly.
Sure. And a big part of creating those coalitions is better policy design. And you offer a few recommendations in your book. I wondered if we could kind of just go through some of the recommendations that you put through. And I know you separated it into various areas, both looking at the corporate environment, how it policy change on the welfare front and the taxation front. So it'd be great to just dive into those.
So what I sought to do to provide some structure to the solutions was restore the work of James Mead to the centre of the policy debate. James Mead was a great disciple of Keynes. He was one of the most important economists of the 20th century, Nobel Prize winner. And what Mead helped us understand is that if you want to move wealth, you've got to move four basic components. You've got to move up people's earnings. You've got to increase their savings rate. You've then got to make sure that they share in the returns that the richest enjoy. And then you've got to figure out how to make sure that net of tax, those at the bottom can also flourish. And so I use that basic checklist to generate a proverbial five-point plan, which is a set of ideas for raising the growth rate, not just in London and the Southeast, but across the UK. Something I call civic capitalism, which is about harnessing the power of pension savers to actually channel money to firms that provide good work, as opposed to participating in a kind of a race to the bottom on wages and standards. Rather than universal basic income, I suggest something called universal basic capital, which is basically rollout of a universal savings account, which then provides a platform for us introducing a much more progressive regime of tax incentives for savings. Something like a sovereign wealth fund for the UK could be a way in which we can provide a democratic participation in the superior returns that sovereign wealth funds can earn. Sovereign wealth funds earn a return globally of about 8% a year. And then the question comes, well, how do you build a sovereign wealth fund? Well, you can build it an awful lot faster if you restore fairness to the tax system. And at a time when a prime minister who earns £2 million a year, Rishi Sunak, is only paying 23% tax, you can see that there's plenty of room to go at there in actually restoring a degree of fairness to the tax system so that you've got a tax system that reflects your moral code. So these ideas may be wrong. There may be people with better ideas. But the book, I suppose, is a provocation to the political class and to the think tank class, the academic class, to say, look, here's a set of ideas that you can find somewhere in the world. Each of these ideas have been tested somewhere. They're practical. They're not so radical as to be impossible. If you fitted them together as a system, you could definitely move the dial on inequality. But if people have got better ideas, then let's hear them. But at least let us have a debate about a structured system of ideas that people will actually vote for in a general election.
Sure. And I guess some of the challenges with enacting the solutions come back to the point before around coalition building and how certain groups might have influence in certain areas of politics. So, I mean, if we just look at reforms in the tax system. There's been a lot of work on this by a number of think tanks over the years on some obvious levers that we might pull. But everything seems to get stuck at the point of, well, I'm going to lose votes if I pull this lever, so I won't pull it as much. And then you end up with a tax system that's incredibly convoluted and confusing. How do we overcome that? How do we overcome some of the political and the practical problems? Because you're right, I think the theory suggests that we could shift the dial on differences in wealth and help level up those at the bottom. It's just, how do we do it in a way that is politically feasible and also in an intelligent way? Because there's always you might have to design policy in a clever way to compensate people. So how do you do it in a practical way?
So the first point is, it's very difficult to do tax policy in opposition. It's quite unwise to do tax policy in opposition because you don't have access to the data that allows you to understand who would be the losers from any particular changes in tax. So these are definitely ideas that are best explored in government. But second, you do need a climate of opinion to take shape. And that's kind of what's happening now around what are broadly called wealth taxes. And the reason for that is because the world has changed. As wealth has multiplied, national household wealth has doubled since the financial crash. But over the course of this century, income from investments has about doubled. So it's about £80 billion at the moment. But broadly speaking, the tax on that investment income is half the rate of tax paid by one in five taxpayers, who are now on 40%. So people can see the kind of inequities really clearly. And what is now accelerating in policy land is a detailed debate about what are the precise measures. So the Wealth Tax Commission, chaired by former Cabinet Secretary Gus O'Donnell, laid out a number of really helpful options. There are campaign groups that are looking at the reform of property taxes. And we're now getting into a world where the OECD itself is beginning to look at this kind of option around inheritance tax reform, for example, and across OECD countries. So you're now beginning to get a catalogue of specific policy measures. And it's so important to get to the specifics, because we know that the way you frame an account of a tax change has a gigantic impact onto the support level. But regardless of those caveats, when you look at the best polling numbers that we've got, and Ben Ansell at Nuffield College in Oxford has done some of the best polling work on this, you can see quite surprisingly high levels of political support across both left and right and between the generations on some quite bold measures. So if, for example, you take the idea of a 1% tax on the 22,000 fortunes that are worth over 10 million, for example, you can actually see very high support levels for this across left and right and between the generations. That's perhaps quite a surprising conclusion. John Penrose, who is my Conservative co-chair of the All Party Group on Inclusive Growth, is somebody who's argued for equalising tax on capital gains and regular income, for example, as Nigel Lawson did back in the 80s. So it's fascinating to see now how we're beginning to get to both a detailed description of specific measures, and people are now beginning to build both the economic case for this, but also the political case for this. So the stage is being set for some reform here, I would think.
Yeah, and, you know, very interesting element of policy design is not just looking at what has and hasn't worked within the UK, but also internationally. And there were a few examples in your book. I wondered if you might be able to kind of run through some of the lessons or the impressive kind of policy ideas that you saw abroad that could be applied here.
On tax in particular?
In general.
Oh, in general. So, well, a couple really stand out. So the fact that 80 countries around the world now have sovereign wealth funds is a really important signal from policy land that sovereign wealth funds are a good way to mobilise investment, which then allows you to create returns which are quite high, which then allows that then give you some choices about what you do with the dividends. My own view was that you use the dividends to provide up to £10,000 in savings match or tax break to young people to help them get a deposit on a home. That's, again, not a novel idea. It's something that the Intergenerational Fairness Commission came up with, chaired by Conservative David Willetts. I gave it a slight tweak by suggesting that we put it in as a tax break or as a savings match rather than cash, because that transforms the level of political support. So sovereign wealth funds and dividends seem to be a sort of quite well-established idea internationally. Second, on the growth side, I mean, we've now got a range of industrial policy taking shape around the world now. That is now very much back in vogue. This idea of mission-driven government is something that Keir Starmer has picked up. If you couple it with quite radical economic devolution, then I think you can have a pretty serious impact on the rate of growth in the UK. And crucially, the supply, the creation and supply of knowledge-intensive jobs. That's important because half the knowledge-intensive jobs are in London and the South East today. And these are jobs which, on average, in the British economy, pay a third more in average wages. So that's an important way to kind of get up the ladder. And there are lots of examples around universal savings accounts, for example. Lots of countries, Singapore is a good example, countries that have got individual learning accounts. And I'm interested in how people build both knowledge capital as well as pension capital and property capital. So again, universal basic capital, you know, sounds like a new idea, but actually it draws on good ideas from around the world. And then on wealth taxes, I would say this is a more novel area. There's obviously been a range of different wealth taxes that have been tried and have failed in OECD countries. The big insight from the Wealth Tax Commission is that you create a small rate of tax on a small number of very wealthy people. So having a 1% tax on fortunes worth over 10 million, that basically bites on about 22,000 households. The reason that that's important is it allows you, as a tax authority, to really get to grips with where the assets are, what they are, and how much they're worth. Where you've had tax systems that introduce wealth taxes on a much, much wider group of people, they run into all kinds of enforcement problems. So it's just quite interesting that you can actually begin to source lots of these ideas from around the world. You can see that they've been tried and tested in lots of different places. But as a politician, I struggled to try and bring all those ideas together, which is why I had to try and produce the book to say, look, there are these ideas out there. Let's think about how you knit them together in a system. And that's the kind of debate that we now need, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we spent a lot of time in the past looking at the drivers behind, you know, why some people get rich and why some people are unable to. And, you know, there's many ways to kind of articulate the challenge, but actually putting forward some policy prescriptions is certainly the best focus. What I wanted to ask was, you know, we've spoken about how government can create coalitions and design policy better. How optimistic are you that you can create coalitions with other MPs in Parliament? Because of course, a big element of this is trying to create a cross-party consensus. And it's great that we have the policy ideas. The other element is now shaping it in a way that's palatable to everyone in Parliament. And I just wanted to kind of get a sense of your optimism around that and also your thoughts on how that can be improved, because I know you obviously work on a number of committees as well.
So this is such a key question, and it's important, because unless we can find what John Rawls used to call that overlapping consensus between left and right, it's really difficult to safeguard policy continuity. How do you make sure that the work of one government is not simply undone by a change of administration, or indeed a change of prime minister, as happened over the last few years? You've got to work harder, I think, in Westminster, where I'm talking to you from now, to find the things that are in common between left and right. So the all-party group on inclusive growth, which is co-chaired by myself and John Penrose, is really, really focused on this task. And so we did a big bit of polling last year across about 40 or 50 different policy measures to try and create a kind of a superset of ideas where we thought there was that consensus. And what was quite interesting about that work is that the ideas basically fell into four categories. There were ideas around agency. So how do we make sure that individuals have the agency that they might need to move themselves on and up in life? There were ideas in the realm of asset building, and that's obviously what the book talks about a lot, so helping people build assets in a faster way. There were then lots of ideas about how you support people moving up the ladder, so a lot of ideas in the education space, as you'd imagine, and then lots of ideas about how you equalise investment in places, what I guess is called levelling up. So that agenda around agency, assets, people and places was quite an interesting takeaway from the big inequality conference that we did last year. And we've got some further work now that is underway with some of our think tank partners and academic partners that we're going to present to a conference in July. And it's not always popular in Westminster working in this cross-party way. But, you know, I've been here 20 years now, and I suppose that the longer I've been here, the more I've recognised that, particularly in a world of polarising politics, we actually have to work harder to find the ideas that we have in common, because those are the ideas that will last the course.
Sure. And just a final question, I guess, you know, one of the challenges with condensing an issue that is as big as inequality is you have to know when to draw the line in your own analysis. And I'm wondering, from where you're sitting right now, after having published the book, have there been any kind of thoughts looking back at the book on prescriptions perhaps that you missed, or things that you wanted to include that you think should require more emphasis in there?
So the key bit that we debated tackling in the book was around how you fitted the prescriptions of the book within a framework that was going to help us save the planet. So in the chapter on tax, there's a lot of, for example, on how you fix carpet bagging and how you tax capital, but there isn't the ideas about how you tax carbon. You know, that bit just didn't make the cut because we needed a particular kind of focus. So bringing this framework into, marrying this framework with the kind of ideas that, for example, Kate Raworth in Donut Economics has set out is something that I would suggest is in the sequel to this book, and that's been what's been fascinating in the debates that we've had on the book so far. That has been one of the two big issues that has come out. The other big issue has been, okay, Labour's 20 points ahead in the polls. Is Labour going to do this? And I have to kind of say, well, look, you know, this is a prescription for a three-term project. The point is that we need to debate about these ideas to check their rights. You've got to work on these ideas in government. But I would say that the big framework that I would put into the sequel to the book would be about how we fit it within new ecological parameters for helping save the planet and hitting the Paris climate change targets.
Fantastic, Liam. Thank you so much. This has been a great discussion. That was Liam Byrne, politician and author of The Inequality of Wealth, Why It Matters and How to Fix It, which is now available in bookstores near you. I've been Tej Parekh, the FT's economics leader writer. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Mia Sorrenti and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.